Log Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2880. That's 2880. We're going to have a really great show tonight. We have his guest on, and he's a returning family member. And he's so involved, you know, with trying to help make a difference in this world in which we live. And he brings out some good points. So it's going to be a very lively discussion. And the telephone number here is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. If you want to be a part of this discussion, or if you just want to listen, that's fine. Well, this is your computers, that's fine. But do listen, because this guy, like I said to him, he has my respect. And those of you that know me know that it takes a lot to get my respect, okay? I like to clown around. Okay. Now, listen to him. Let me first of all read the mission statement. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one is educating the public, especially as relating to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And he'll tell us just how many people it affects. I know he knows that, maybe even the latest stats, which would be very good. Okay. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Now, people always say to me, Carol, why do you emphasize prevention? To me, that's the biggest part. I mean, we have prevention, intervention, and recovery. Don't get me wrong. Recovery is very important. And intervention, learning how to do that, is very important. But prevention of, to me, is like starting in the homes and in the schools and all this other stuff. If we give the tools to the people to work with so that they can become a part of, and that's what we need, is for society to care enough to become a part of. Now, tonight we have Mike Pickenin with us from Hawkins, Minnesota, and he is a returning family member. Mike is all about working on prevention, intervention in his home state. He's the founder and president of Kids at Risk Action, CARA, K-A-R-A, a nonprofit action tank that supports the people, policies, and programs that improve the lives of at-risk children. Mike knows all the statistics of child abuse. He recently worked on a local PSA project and asked us at NASCA for ideas about how a survivor can start a recovery group. We recommend his book. It's called The Invisible Children, Preteen Mothers, Adolescent Felons, and What We Can Do About It. That's what we need, is solutions. I'm very solution-oriented. It's an uncomfortably close look at the American cycle of abuse and its cost. Mike explains the need for civic involvement of young future community leaders in the solution to America's at-risk problem Without today's college students' understanding and support, schools will continue to fail. Streets will be unsafe and jails to the full. Okay? And there's a lot of truth in that. I think it's more a total society, but there's a lot of truth because I've worked in universities, and I'm going to tell you something. I didn't like what I saw. Michael often speaks at local and national venues and has been the keynote speaker at businesses, community, and religious organizations. Okay? He's led a workshop in the UN in New York and addressing the rights of children. Okay? He's just done so much. He's been a court-appointed special advocate for CASA, and has worked with many invisible children, as he calls them, and that's exactly what they are, because we children, as children, we had no voice. We were the invisible children who are part of the county child protection system. That's who he works with, the county child protection system, these children. And his email address is mike@invisiblechildren.org. That's mike@invisiblechildren.org. So there you go. So before I have him get started, and I do hope this becomes a really lively show, because some people are going to totally agree, other people are going to learn from this. I hope they do learn from this, because I've done an awful lot of public speaking in different places. I know the things that you can run into with people and attitudes and all this other stuff. And sometimes I just think it's ignorance. There's another telephone number here that's come in. This is a 617 area code. Who am I speaking? This is Carol Levine.
Hi, Miss Carol. This is Miss Nancy.
Hey, Nancy. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. Okay, so we have a nice little panel here. And people, I'm going to give out this telephone number again, because feel free to call in and be a part of what Mike has to offer us, okay? The telephone number here is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. And so now I can put my mission statement aside. I've explained that a little bit. And do get to know our website. That's www.NASCA.org. That's NASCA.org. You can learn a lot of information from our website, okay, how to speak to your children, what to say, what not to say, age appropriate, the whole nine yards. Okay, so I wanted to start with our guest here tonight because, again, he has a lot of good info in his bio, and I like how he thinks. So, Mike, why don't you tell us a little something about yourself? I mean, you are a survivor, yes, no?
I became a guardian ad litem child advocate in 1996,
mm-hmm.
And that's my.
Okay.
I came out of a lot of alcohol as a child, but as a practical matter, it was getting involved with the CASA organization as an advocate for children and child protection that opened my eyes to how our society treats other people's children. And it's been a long journey. We started the nonprofit in 2000, and we've done a lot of projects. I've had experience removing about 50 children from really unhappy homes over the years. And now it's become clear that you know, with COVID, things have gotten a lot worse, and that was one of the things I hope to talk about this evening, along with the work that we're doing at CARE, Kids at Risk Action, to have more impact through different programs that we are working on. Is that a good place to start?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you're quite right. I mean, with the COVID as it is, we know as survivors, okay, we know that a lot of the abuse starts at home. So to be stuck in the house with your abusive parent, whomever, maybe it's a sibling, certainly is a terrible thing. Go ahead and go from there. That's fine. Yeah, go right ahead.
I'm going to make the point that the statistics, there's never been transparency or reasonable reporting on child abuse. Now, we know that 80% of kids aging out of foster care lead dysfunctional lives. We've known that for a long time. But we really don't know. And state by state, and that's the reporting I do, I've been writing and researching on this for a long, long time, we get bits and pieces of information through the media, but there is no whole picture painted. People don't understand. I don't think that we live in a society of mean people. I don't think that. I do think that this is a hard subject, and that people avoid it. We euphemize, we obfuscate. We're not direct. We don't speak openly about this. There's shame that comes with it, I suppose, from our side. You know, if people have experienced it, so a lot of people don't talk about it. A lot of people go through life without talking about it. But for Kids at Risk Action, we are passionate and outspoken, and we try to start these conversations
Hey, Mike, yeah. Do you have your speakers on? Does someone have their speakers on?
I hear that too, but that's not me.
Me neither.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So to start, I'm going to just talk a little bit about how serious the impact COVID has been. And it's not, and so the children that are impacted by it are impacting our community, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. But even though child abuse reports are down sometimes 50% to 70%, that is no indication that anything got better during COVID. These kids were locked into toxic homes. There weren't mandated reporters. They couldn't go to school. And the stresses that impacted their lives drove parents and caregivers to alcohol and drug abuse, and they were tied into those homes themselves. So the anxiety, fear, and frustrations really were much worse for you, much worse. And so pre-COVID, there was about 3.5 million cases a year being reported to Child Protective Services in the country, representing at least 6 million children, probably more. The average number of kids in Child Protective Service cases is no longer one or two. Those are larger families now. People stay in the system, 3, 4, 5, 6 youth, and it's not uncommon to see more. So those youth have behavior problems. There's a lot of issues. It's a sadness. We haven't, as you mentioned about the universities and teaching, we really haven't given the attention that ACEs deserves, adverse childhood experiences. In the future, I believe that the ACEs model of mental health explaining is going to replace pretty much the DSM, that Bible of mental health that is primarily labeling, where we know that adverse childhood experiences are measurable now. We can tell by how many of them a child has suffered, kind of help they need, how severe it is. And so we have tools we've never had before. We have knowledge we've never had before. So on the one hand, I can be very optimistic about what we could do. And I think to your point, I know that your organization is really focused on prevention. And to your point about community and how important community is, I'm going to tell a story that I'm involved in the middle of right now in my state, where the organization that I became a volunteer in, CASA Guardian Ad Litem, you know, basically I worked with children in child protection. I was their voice in court, and they're all over the country. But in my state now, they've got funding for paid guardians, so they're trying to diminish the role of the, you know, managing guardians is harder, volunteer guardians is harder because they take fewer cases and there are more of them, and they find it easier to work with paid guardians. Well, paid guardians will have, like a social worker will have, 30 cases perhaps, maybe 100, 120, 130 youth. And the difference of care those kids get, the difference in advocacy, the argument that we make, is that I never took more than one or two cases at a time. And guardians like me, some people did, some volunteers did, but I was able to really pour my heart into the cases I had, and I think I had more of an impact than a paid guardian would. I'm really unhappy that our system, institutions are really being overwhelmed right now, and I understand why they would want a model that just had paid people and higher caseloads, and it's more of a factory in my eyes. I believe firmly that the community should be more involved. There have been thousands since 90s, oh, I'm trying to think of when it started, mid-80s, I think, in my state, the Guardian Ad Litem program for volunteers. Community members come forward and want to volunteer, and it's a highly selective process because you have to make sure people are going to be capable of being good guardians. So only half or a third of the people that apply as a rule get in. And around the country, there are some states that don't have paid guardians. All they have are the volunteer guardians. So I'm so sold on the idea of involving the community. The people that I know that have been guardians have gone on after retirement to do other things in the world of child protection. One of the women in my state had money, and she spent $1 million building homes for foster youth aging out. There are stories that I have that the people in our communities, if they were aware, if we talked more about who we are, what we know, what we do, what needs to be done, will come out and help. They will do things. I find that when I talk to people individually about this subject, there are no politics. And we are a political nation, and I don't want to go there. But as a practical matter, when I talk to people about what I know about child protective services, what I know about child abuse and childhood trauma and Prozac and foster care and all those things, people listen. We can all agree that the children that live next door, or down the block, or across the street in the town deserve a chance. There's a lot of trouble when you get up into the criminal element and they don't want people to have a second chance, and that hurts me. But if they understood that today's, I talk about statistics, so don't get mad at me, but every once in a while I do this, but 9-year recidivism in our prison system is reaching 90%. And our Chief Justice, former Chief Justice, Supreme Court Chief Justice in Minnesota, has said that 90% of the kids in juvenile justice have come through child protective services. Marion Wright Edelman's been saying it for years, and it's true. I mean, really, basically, generational child abuse is what's eating our country alive. Kids that come from really terrible homes, if they don't get help, if they don't find the path, they're going to have families just like the one they came from. And as I said earlier, it's no longer true that the cases in the courtroom for child protection have one or two kids as a rule. Those cases have families that have been in the system for 5, 10, 20 years, multiple children, mothers without parenting skills, violent boyfriend, a drug habit. And then, really, the behavior problems that come from the traumas their children grow up with pretty much ensure that that's going to happen in another generation. So I talk about the cost to society, and I talk about how we can impact them by talking more about it, being louder, outspoken, learning more about it. I want to point out our website has been there for almost 20 years. It's got thousands of pages on it, and hopefully it's fairly easy to read. But for information, we are a source. We've been followed by Reuters, Bloomberg News, Chicago Tribune over the years. We have a couple programs we're working on. But before I get to those, I do want to talk about the impact our kids, our abused and neglected children, are having on our communities, on our teachers, on our law enforcement, on our social workers, our healthcare workers. There's almost no state that has adequate foster care. Group homes are being closed for many reasons that have to do with not being able to keep up. I mean, the impact of really damaged youth is overwhelming. It's overwhelming our communities at many levels. I use Rikers Island as an example in New York. I mean, they don't know what to do with Rikers Island. I mean, the level of damage that's been done to those kids, and now they've been in the system for so long, and they've been punished with isolation. They've been punished it's punished children. It's always been wrong. And we have never as a nation identified how to treat differently children that grew up in abusive homes. Kids that already hate authority, they've been abused by the most authoritative figure in their life, and they're not going to respond well to a cop in a uniform. They're not going to respond well. That's why educators have such a tough job these days. It's hard being a teacher with my kids. I had a young boy who was about 12, and he was a small boy, beat up his teacher so bad she quit, sued the state. I feel awful. I mean, I've seen things. It just pains me to know that being a teacher is no longer fun. Being law enforcement is no longer fun. Healthcare workers are doing what they can, and there's answers here by going back. We know what to do. The best part, the worst part, is that we know what to do. We know that the ACEs trauma healing models and a different way of managing at-risk youth needs to become the way we do things. No more squad cars. No more using police in the schools. You can't beat kids like this into submission, which is what we've been doing, and that's why the prisons are full. And if you look at the data, that's where statistics come in and the money being spent. It's outrageous. And so the good news.
Okay, let me ask you something. Okay.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Hold that, and then we're going to go to the panel. That thought right there. Now remember, I used to work in detention. I've told you that before. Now I have to admit that what you're saying is true, because all these kids came from dysfunctional homes, obviously, many of them. If I had to give a percentage, I'd say 98%, okay? They came from dysfunction. All they ever knew in their life was violence and other types of abuses. So therefore, that's how they were molded. That's what they got used to. And then they became, as they were growing up, getting a little bit older, getting into the teenage years, they became, kids out on the street. They became kids that were in trouble and all this other stuff. And, yes, many times it is generational. Many, many times it's generational. So what we need is for the social workers, yes, or someone, to go in. They have to be trained better, too, by the way, to go into the homes, say a foster care, because you mentioned that briefly, foster care many times is just simply not up to par, or into the homes themselves where the kids came from, and to be trained, because you see, if we tell them ahead of time, we're going to be there Tuesday at 5 o'clock, well, you can be sure the house is going to be spick and span. The kids are going to be lined up. They're going to be all, nice and clean. And the kids are going to have braids in their hair and whatever they need or whatever. And you know what I'm saying. They're going to be told what to say, what not to say. We need to have better training. And this is where I would get into arguments over at universities. Because I was speaking to, the college students and sometimes police officers as well. But, you can't do that. It's better to give a little window of opportunity. In other words, I'll be there probably on Tuesday, but I'm not sure. It might be Wednesday. I usually would say a day ahead of time instead of a day before, because then they'd start to clean, right? So I'll fix their butts. They'll do it a day after and show up on Tuesday. Give them a 5-minute, hey, I'm coming over now. I thought you said Wednesday. No, it's going to have to be today. This way they don't have time to prepare. You see, there's so much of that going on in the homes. So when the social workers come in and they inspect the homes and they try to speak to the kids, they're programmed, if they're given the opportunity to be told how to behave and all this other stuff, and then they write a wonderful report. You see? They do assessment, evaluation, and there you go. So go ahead.
I'm going to point out that during COVID, there just haven't been the in-home visits. These kids have been locked in these homes with these people. And what happens then when the computer screen comes up and the caretaker's in the room or, you know, within earshot, this has gotten to be a horrendous problem. It was already awful pre-COVID. It was. The numbers were off the charts pre-COVID. Domestic violence, you know, being raped or watching your mother raped is not that different as far as the level of trauma, the beatings,
right.
the violence. And my point is that as a society, we have never supported to the extent that needs to be supported quality daycare, early childhood programs, taking care of young families. You know, we live in a money-driven society. That's always been the way it is. But it didn't have to be such a selfish society. And I'm going to go back to what I said earlier about people not knowing. People don't know. You know, if you've never experienced abuse, if you're not, you know, and what they think, you know, some of the people I talk to, and I do talk a lot about it, so I get this spec once in a while, somebody hit his kid. That's what they think abuse is. They think that, well, dad hit the kid, and he got reported. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about living in a home where the beatings are regular, where the kind of things that happen are done because of alcohol and drugs and generational abuse, where kids are living. They don't get into the system. Usually the oldest child has been at it, been abused for 4 years. I believe that's old data because there isn't data. When you get into data, I just can't believe we don't have the data on self-harm, self-cutting, self-suicide, you know, attempts of suicide. I can go on about how there are sporadic pieces of data about these things. But if we knew those things, maybe we would do something as a people. But again, it comes back to who's going to say what. The media doesn't cover it because it doesn't sell newspapers. And it's hard to get information. It's hard. So it is up to the people that know to have these conversations. I speak at Rotaries pretty regularly. The idea is when I talk about money. This is cost, you know, it depends on the group, but Rotaries and business groups, I can tell them, what do you think it costs to have kids in the system for 50 years? Because
that's
they
right.
come through child protection, juvenile justice, you've got 90% recidivism at 9 years at the prison system. How much do you think that costs? Those are your tax dollars. Wouldn't you rather not spend that?
And then those that have to go, you know, because they're mentally ill from it, you know, they have all kinds of psychological deficiencies and they have It's huge.
Sheriff Dart out of Chicago runs the largest mental health factory in the country, and he talks about that. And they aren't, you know, actually, I have a happy story about that. I years ago went to talk to the head of the county commissioners in my city, and she runs all the money for the things that I needed, and we needed money for mental health services for kids and child protective services. And we met in a library quiet room. I have two board members. And at the end of my pitch for that, she said, there is no constituency. And I was mad. I said things I probably shouldn't have said. She had been our mayor where I live, and then she became the commissioner. And I got kicked by one of my board members, and we ended on unhappy terms. Because basically she said, it's not a big enough issue. Well, if she had any idea, if her head was on straight, she would have known. So here's the happy part of the story. A couple years later, one of my friends asked me, who runs another nonprofit, to join him to talk to her. And I went, and he gave me 5 minutes. And that day, this is where I'm not a religious person, but that day in the Star Tribune of my city's newspaper, the Sheriff Stanek was threatening to sue the county and the state for not providing timely mental health services to the people in his squad cars and jail cells. And I took that paper with me, and when I talked to her, I said, Jan, I said, you may not remember me, but the last time I was talking, and last time we spoke, I said, I asked for $5 million for children's mental health, and you said there's no way. Well, now these people are suing you. Why can't we sue you? You don't want to be on the wrong side of this. And by God, Carol, she got involved in it. I won't tell you the whole story, but basically she got involved in what we were doing, and $25 million showed up on the table in the following biennium. So
fantastic.
It is a matter of understanding. And people aren't by definition mean. It's just misinformed, uninformed. They need us to talk about it. They need us to write about it, call our state reps. Again, I have on Kids at Risk Action, invisiblechildren.org, all the information you'll ever need. Send me an email and I'll send you what you want, you know, as far as the data that I have, the stories that we have. And I do want to make sure I get in a couple of minutes to talk about my financial literacy program for at-risk youth that I want to see happen in every state. So let me know when we get down to about 3-4 minutes.
Okay, hold on a second, Mike, because we have another caller here. And I do want to go to the panel. I want to start out with Michelle Bless in just a second here. 619 area code, this is Carol Levine. Who am I speaking to?
Hi, Carol Levine. It's Regular Girl. Wow. You are fabulous.
Yes.
You are great. I think that the system is so broken, but you have a way of articulating your experience and knowledge that I think what you're doing here today by just simply speaking is so powerful, and more people just simply need to hear this aspect of the gemstone, because it's going to be beautiful. We're going to do it with people like you. You are fabulous. Thank you so much for doing this. And I think there are some other networks that might like, who have others of similar mind, you know, who are in uproar also about human trafficking. And, you know, there's other points of, in common that we can meet with others. So there are some other networks that I know about that I'm sure the host would love to have you as a guest. And because I know that even with, I don't know how many people are listening to this now, which is wonderful, but it's certainly not as many as who's going to see it on CNN or Fox News tonight. You know what I'm saying? And that it's those we need to get that kind of presence with the information
this
that you have here.
And
we should get you on Joe Rogan. We'll get you on Joe Rogan. See, if it needs to spread like that, that's what we'll do. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for all of that. And Mike, you know, this is wonderful. You see, I got all excited when I read the bio, because I did tell the others, and I'm going to go to them because they want to say hello to you and maybe ask you a question or something. But, you know, this is important. You see, unfortunately, we are a people that a lot of times we don't think about anything until it hits our pocketbook. And then when you start talking about how much money it takes, you know, to work in the system, to try and gather up these children who have gone astray, and from the mental illness part of you, which I used to work with also, and then, of course, the juvies, the juvenile delinquents, a lot of times then they end up in prison, don't they? Or they end up committing suicide because they're so upset. And I don't call these bad kids. I call them confused kids. Of course they're confused, all right? I was a confused kid. I turned out okay, I think. But let me go up to Michelle. I want to go down the list here so that everyone can say hello to you, maybe ask you a question, and then we'll get back to what you're talking about. It's fascinating, and it's information that we need to know. We need solutions. We need more shows where we can talk about this, where people like yourself come on, and I have some knowledge of it, and other people have knowledge of it too, to sit, to talk, to speak, and to get involved. Okay. Here's Michelle Bless. Okay. She's our minister, and she's from Cincinnati, Ohio, and she may have a question she might want to ask or make a comment. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hey, how you doing? I'm so glad that you're here. It's more so of a comment I want to make. He said so many things, and I want to make this comment. You said that you had people that donated a lot of money to invest in foster homes and stuff like that. Is that correct?
In one individual, I was making the point that if they eliminate the volunteer program in Minnesota, there are 10,000 people like me over the years. Many of them have gone on to do wonderful things for at-risk kids, and Denise Graves is her name. They have $1 million to build foster homes for kids aging out. Wow.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
If only 1 out of 100 did a good thing, not even that big, that's still a lot being done in your community.
Okay, so yeah, that's good. So I wanted to piggyback on that. So I think that's great that that person donated $1 million to build a foster home, and I hope that I hear so many people contribute a lot of finances to build foster homes to make it better than the actual other foster homes have been. You know what I'm saying? Like back in our day, you know, a lot of sexual abuse not only happened in the homes, but they happen also in foster care. And for me, I would say that the way the foster care system is today, is it 100%? No. I will say that it's much better now than it was then, but it still has a whole lot of work to do. For me, I want to say what I do is I have a lot of people that donate financially and other resources to my ministry, because not only do we just get the child out of the home and put them in a safe place, but we also get, you know, we have resources where we make sure they are receiving therapy. We walk with them all the way until they become an adult, a young adult, turning 18, getting their high school diploma, helping them get a job. Then we help them get an apartment. We help them get a car. I mean, I've been doing this for so long. Those are the ones that didn't fall on the wayside. But you have a lot that I have seen. I'm talking personally that I have seen that went into a resource of a foster care, and they're there away from the home where they were abused, but that's it. They get therapy, but then that's it. This is a long care situation when it deals with children who have been sexually assaulted and abused, and it takes people like you and more for us to help them and to help them walk all the way through until they become a young adult, you know, so they can learn the difference than what they learned as a child. And like what me and Carol talked about a long time ago, a young little girl and a young little boy, we look up to, me being a survivor of sexual abuse is why I'm saying this, we look up to adults, right? So once that protection is taken away, because we're introduced to abuse, and then you're introduced to the savage of it, okay? Meaning if a little boy get raped by a man, well, first of all, he's going to feel pain, right? And then he don't even understand what sex is all about. He's not even in the point of his sexuality. So he's introduced to a sexuality of abuse. You see what I'm saying? So the same with a little girl, introduced to that sort of sexual abuse, that painful. It's painful when a child is being ripped apart by an adult individual. And then to be introduced to allegedly what love is supposed to be, what sex is supposed to be, it's going to come out negative. So if we don't spend the resources on spending time with these children once we take them away from home and put them in a foster care for safety, we need to do not only giving them the therapy that they need, of course, but having someone with them continuously to show them what love really is instead of the love that they were introduced. I have seen so many kids, yes, they got snatched out of the homes of abuse. They go into a foster care system. And then I saw them fall on the wayside. When I witnessed it, I personally stepped in. But then I can come into an organization, the organization would tell me what they do for victims of abuse, and already I read a locker full of kids that have become teenagers that fell on the wayside. So my question to you is, what you do, have you followed children that you have helped get out of a situation of abuse, come into a safe place, and doing good in their lives today besides just the therapy part? I'm talking about, am I making sense in what I'm saying?
Aftercare. That's what you're talking about.
The aftercare is very important.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of kids falling on the wayside. And then you mentioned something else, too, I want to bring up because it just came to my thought. You were talking about the percentage of kids who are cutters. If you can say what you said when you mentioned that, and then I'll respond.
Well, the point I make about cutters and child suicide, and I'm going to preface this by saying that we have had literally hundreds of students from colleges all over the country join us in a second book for research and writing. And one of my key areas of research is that. Because there is no reporting. Individual hospitals, yes. Actually, if you look into Dallas, Texas, last year I've lost the numbers. I don't have it in my head right now. But horrendous amount of kids under 10 coming in trying to kill themselves. And again, nothing at all on self-harm cutting, the other kinds. And there's so much of it and so little reported that I'm actually, that's one of my hot spots. Because I've lived with it. Kids that didn't want to be here. They hate themselves. They think they're guilty. They think they started it. They think they caused it. They ruin their family. Yeah. It's so sad. So you really do have, you know, that's what we're trying to do at our organization. We're trying to gather the information. We're trying to make it into both social media and a finished product as a book. There's a documentary. I shouldn't say documentary. We're doing videos on these particular things. So I don't know if I answered your question or not. But
you did.
I want to
respond. First of all, I'm glad to hear what you are absolutely doing when it comes to that, because that is such a, I call it a quiet storm. And let me explain what I mean. Okay. It's well known there's sexual child abuse going on. It's been going on for a long time, right? But they never talk about the after effect of what it does to a child and what level it takes that child to after being removed. By the time they're removed from a home, I'm going to tell you something. The percentage, because I can give it to you, it's absolutely up there as much as 98% of children who are being sexually abused. And let's go to another level. It's 98% of cutters in suicide. Absolutely. They cut because before they cut, all they feel is the pain and then the memory at the same time of them feeling the pain of the abuse is actually seeing what happened to them, what's been going on with them in the sexual abuse. So as a young mind, what they do to ease that pain is cut. Some people feel like, well, I would think that's worse. No, that's their let out. That gives them a let out. That gives them a moment of peace for just those few seconds, and they'll keep cutting. I'm very familiar with that because I'm a survivor, so that's why I know. Suicide, of course, children don't want to live because they have been so programmed by their abuser that you like it or it's your fault, or then they put in threats of harming their loved ones. Their mommy or their daddy or their brother or sister if they tell. So imagine having all this that you have to carry as a little child. That's when that suicide come in. They don't want to live. They don't want to be here anymore. And there's a lot of kids that have took their lives, and people don't even realize why. So I appreciate
Michelle,
you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. we lose at least, and now because of the pandemic, when that all started, it was 7 kids a day, you know, to suicide. Now it's doubled. And the reason why that has doubled, maybe almost tripled at this point, I'm going to look into those stats, if we can believe them.
Well, I want to add to you what you just said, Carol. You're absolutely, yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off, but the thought came on my mind. Mm-hmm. You are absolutely correct when you said, I want to check on a triple. I can help you with that. It has tripled.
Me and my team,
since the pandemic, and the virus hit, in 2019. We are in our fourth year of this. Now keep in mind that because of the change of the world, because of the pandemic and people losing their jobs or they can't put their kids in daycare or school anymore because they can't afford it and they're locked in the house. And so it's more going on now, the rise of abuse is higher now than ever before. People say, are you serious? I'm like, yes. So it's just being part of the court system, being a chaplain and a minister of the court system.
Yep.
So it allows me to connect with children's services and stuff like that. And I basically, they'll give me the list of kids who are not in school. But they're at school at home, and we just go and check. We don't even call and let them know we come in. And so I want to say this real quick, and I'm done. So what I do, when we go to these homes, as a surprise, they don't expect us. If there is a sign of abuse that I feel that's going on, something ain't right, because keep in mind, these kids are programmed by foster parents or if they're in their regular homes with their parents. I basically will take the child and tell them, okay, I'm going to go talk to your child. They think I'm going to go to another room, but we're going out the door. And it's, well, where are you going? In my car. Well, can you do that? Yes, I can. You have a problem? Because I have cops with me. So while the cops are talking to them, I'm taking the kid in my car. I'm out to give them a safe haven. And I could start talking about, oh, I remember when I was a little girl and, you know, and the person who hurt me told me if I tell, they was going to hurt my mommy or it was going to hurt my sibling. And if that kid is abused because it happened, they would say, really, it happened to you when you were a little girl? And I'm like, well, yeah, it happened to me. And just like God sent someone to help me, I'm here to help you. So my question to you is, if you are being abused in any way that is bad, you have the opportunity to tell me, and I promise you, you would not go back in that house.
Okay, Michelle, what you're saying is
that time work. Yeah.
Yes. Now that's wonderful, but we need all the social workers. You see, we need all the people like Mike is talking about, like I know about also, and you know about also. They have to be taught, okay, how to speak to the children better, what signs to look for, you know, the red flags. Because a lot of times kids will stand there. I've seen it. They'll stand there stiff as a board, and they'll have their eyes
cast down.
And
that's why I'm sharing. That's why I'm sharing what to look for. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
You're going to find kids fall on the wayside. Every social worker ain't for the right thing. I have talked to a caseworker who said, because a child was burned to death, viciously raped for 5 years.
Right.
And she said, well, I got 120 caseloads. Well, you know what? You in the wrong business.
That's what we hear.
Every caseload you got, you should have went and investigated that child. Each caseload you do.
No, I had over 80 at a clinic.
And I
can't do that.
And
can't
me and my
that,
team,
Michelle.
We're going. We going.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, that's an excuse. That's an excuse to me.
Okay. Now,
so,
let me continue on, honey, because we have a full panel here. People want to talk, too. But what you're saying is quite right. Mike certainly knows it. I know it because I worked it. And you work it. So this is the problem within the system. And somehow, some way, we the people have to have a voice. Yes, it's a wonderful thing for the teenagers or the college students to be made more aware of. And then they can bring forth, because we've said before on NASCA, kids are more apt to listen to kids. Okay? So if you get the kids in the right frame of mind and also, too, in the right timing, however which way they would arrange to do that in the school system, then they would listen. They'd listen and become more aware. By the time they get into the universities, which is what I dealt with and still do, then they're more apt to listen, to observe, and all this other stuff. And the professors, the ones who are involved and supposed to know more than they have to either be taught or keep the damn mouth shut. And you know when I say that, I'm mad. Okay. Because they don't know what they're doing. I swear to God. Okay, let me go down to, now, 702, I think you had the Nancy before. Is that right? Or who am I speaking to, 702 area code?
Hi, my name is Sylvia.
Sylvia, okay. Let me get your name in here. Okay, let me get you in here. Okay, all right, that's great. Sylvia, do you have a question that you'd like to ask or to make a comment?
Right now, I'm going to hold off because the information or the comment is just so broad and so important. I just want to see what I can feed off of others and their experience.
Yeah.
Because I haven't really worked in specifically helping children in child abuse.
Uh-huh.
So I want to speak, and I didn't have this type of abuse of trauma in my life, of being sexually abused. So I'm just going to listen to others and see if a question comes up while I'm here. Thank you.
Well, that's fine. That's fine, Sylvia. And, you know, a lot of times when you're listening to a show, all of a sudden you do have a question, and it's good to write it down even, and so that when I get around to you again, you've got it right there. So that's good. And hopefully tonight you'll get a lot more information. And what we're trying to do is, I'm sure what Mike is trying to do too, he's explaining, this is his show. He's explaining, you know, how they're doing it at their end and sharing things with us. Okay, now let me go down to Nancy. Nancy, do you have a question or
a comment?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, good evening, everybody. You guys pretty much touched on a few of the things that I was going to talk about. So I'm enjoying listening. Thank you, Mike, for your bravery and sharing your story. And just kind of sharing with us, you know, how what you're doing to help make changes for other children that are going through this right now. Definitely, you know, when just like you guys have been talking, you know, kids are programmed, they're scared, they're not going to tell right away. They're not going to open up right away. So I believe Michelle just mentioned, you know, that she takes them to a separate area. I think that's such a smart thing and such a wonderful thing to do, because when the child is in that space of, you know, being around the abuser or where the abuse is taking place, children tend to shut down. And definitely taking them aside and speaking to them and letting them know, you know, getting on their level and letting them know that, you know, that you've been through abuse and, you know, you are a child, little things like that. Because I know when I was younger and I had people try to speak to me, automatically if they, you know, and everybody's different, you know, I'm not saying that you cannot be in the field if you haven't been through abuse, but something about experiencing that level of abuse and then meeting someone who can relate to you, you really don't get that. Most of the people
that's
that you meet when you've been through abuse are people who have the heart for it, which is nice, or people who are just there for their job, which, you know, they don't even have the heart, which is even more scary, and it makes you clam up and really not open up. But having that person hold you by your hand and say, listen, I've been there. I went through what you've been through. What? I mean, as a child, I didn't meet children that were sexually abused. I didn't meet adults who went through sexual abuse. I was, like, alone in my journey. Like, I had nobody. you know, and people were not properly trained back then. So right now, just hearing everything that's being put in place, and, I mean, it does require funding. It does require money. We do need money for some of these, for these programs to be run. You know, people, I mean, everything's expensive nowadays. People have families to raise. So, yes, we have a lot of volunteers, but it is important for people who have the heart and have the funding, even if they haven't been through it, if you have the heart for it, invest in it because it's needed. There are kids out here.
Yes.
In these situations still today, right now, I mean, it's unimaginable, honestly, when I think about the type of abuse that we've endured and to think that it's still happening today. Like, kids, people are still waking up to this abuse today. Like, it breaks my heart. I'm not going to lie. I mean, you know, but there is so much that we can do. There are so many opportunities for volunteers to get involved, even with NASCA and with other organizations and other ministries like you all shared. So, again, I'm just honored to be here, and I'm going to be done so that other people can get a chance. And thank you for sharing again, Mr. Mike.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy, for that. I want to go down to Regular Girl and see if she has something that she'd like to say, and then I'm going to get back to Mike and have him explain. He's got an awful lot here to speak about yet. He wants to start a recovery group, and then also, too, about preteen mothers, adolescent felons, and what can we do about it. One thing, I have a question with you, Mike, with the, you know, when they age out, you see, this is where the aftercare comes in. I think if we had more, I think if we had more involvement with aftercare, you know, and again, where's that money going to come from? All right, you're going to have programs, and you need money for that. It's like it's a catch-22 because there's more that needs to be done, and yet they don't know who's going to fund it. So there's a lot of things to really talk about here. Let me go down to Regular Girl and see if she has something she'd like to make a comment about, and we'll get back to Mike.
I'll comment on what you just said about the money, because I have some thoughts about that, which is it's actually one big one, which is as much as, you know, it can be shown how we will save money by addressing this, unfortunately, there are people who make money on this in many aspects.
That's right.
And I think that will reveal itself. And right. And that takes down another, you know, another group of trails, so to speak. But here's the other thing. You mentioned, Carol, and you did too, about politics and about how this is an issue that is not political. However, when you think about what it is that we are addressing, is we want to care for children, right? But aren't we also saying in a way, like, who are these experts? What is it, and who is it that's going to say this is the product. This is what we wanted to achieve. This is the kind of human being that we think is functional. Functional for whom? Functional as what? And this bit, and I think that there are also people who, when you start to talk about just simply being allowed in someone's, just coming into people's houses and monitoring them, we're also, that brings up some important issues. It does. Because, like, as an example, I'm watching this Netflix series called Shtizel, and so it's about ultra-Orthodox Jews. That's what they call themselves, ultra-Orthodox, living in Jerusalem. And it's in current times. So what happens at some – but, you know, ultra-Orthodox Jews have their own rabbinical court. It's based on the Torah, you know. And so when this – but they're living in current-day Jerusalem, and the government has started to get involved in their lives, even in the forms of child protection. And there's a scene where you can see, because you've been watching it, that, yes, oh, this thing happened, and it could easily look like to someone that there's been abuse here, you know. And it's an ultra-Orthodox Jewish man who's also becoming an artist. But when you, as the viewer, start to see this interference, it comes up as that. And who, because we're talking about values. What is a good parent? We want to be, if you're a guardian, right? I'm assuming, or maybe let me ask you this, and then I'll stop, and I want to give you more time. It's like the, when we talk about having the heart to do it. See, I think that maybe just having the heart is, you know, that's a little too vague. So maybe, you know, it shouldn't be said quite like that, or it should be done only by the heart, you know. But what do you think about what it is that I'm saying in terms of who is it that determines someone is even qualified to be a good parent? What are the values? That's what we have to start to talk about. That's what is being talked about, right? So this gets into cultural issues and religious issues as well. So, you know, it is going to involve
a lot of different areas. Yeah, it does. You're right. It covers a lot of different areas. You're right. It's cultural. Look, we know that it's cultural. Look at all the different, you know, people around us, okay? This one is this one. This one's that one. This one is this. So it then does turn into a culture. And sometimes that can get in the way, okay? Because when that happens, when it's cultural, yes, that can definitely get in the way.
Did
I lose it? And that can cause problems. Mm-hmm. Let's get back to Mike. I had my eyes shut. I was listening, and all of a sudden I had a black screen. Oh, no. All right. So, okay. Those are good points, too. Everyone's making very, very good points here. So you have a lot to talk about. Believe me. Mike, go ahead.
I'll mention some of the projects that we are involved in, and always looking for interest, partners, collaborators. You mentioned that if anyone here has connections to other larger formats, I'm really grateful for any introductions or referrals you might make so that we can talk to more people in this way. So I will talk about our new financial literacy program for youth aging out of foster care. Actually, it's for multiple populations of at-risk youth. We are starting in a foster advocacy group that works with kids aging out. And nationally, for decades, 80% is the average of kids leading dysfunctional lives that come through systems. And just as a sidebar to what has been said about foster homes, I do a lot of research on the states, and I don't know of a state that has adequate group homes, adequate foster care families. We're underwater in that area. The training, you know, what we ask foster parents to do, you know, basically we've all become mental health workers. The ACEs work is real. Behavior problems are serious. These kids have a lot of problems, and they do things, and they say things, and they interrupt the kids in the home. It really is hard. Some states much worse than others. But group homes, you know, that's kind of the last resort now is private group homes, and I have some terrible stories about how they work. We should do better. So our financial literacy program is different. It is a year-long program. We are raising money and have been able to fund each youth for $1,250 during the course of that year. We have a bank, the only bank in the state, that helps kids work with a credit rating, kids that have bad credit or no credit. So at the end of the year, they have a credit rating. They have an account at Schwab, and they know how to save money. I could go on as far as the ability to find a good job, or if you can't find a good job, what the entrepreneurial side of things looks like, and a side gig, and how to make money, and mostly how to invest in yourself. We show kids the value of you know, the earning power you have as a human being in the years to come is going to be what you know. And decisions are reversible, but learning is not. So we help kids figure out, and I have in my past helped kids figure out a thing they could do for money. Usually abandoned kids, kids that have had terrible abuse in their lives, hate authority. They don't like listening to other people tell them what to do. They don't make good employees. It takes a lot of, it adds stress to their lives. And so a lot of kids would really be better off learning how to do a thing. And again, decisions are reversible. My sister made a pretty good penny, and I mean that, really good money, cleaning houses some years ago. I've got kids that have done pretty well with their ability to paint. There's just, we live in an economy that is ripe and open to that if you can manage yourself. And so that's part of what this is. Over the next year, these kids form a peer group, small groups of 5 to 8 kids, and there's a trainer in there. That's the person that's from the organization that remains in the group after we leave. And we remain in touch with that person. And if we're funded well enough, we'll try and help them in the second year with money, but mostly just to be a resource. So we think we can turn around that 80% to 10 or 5. We really have high hopes for this program with the youth that we work with. And before long, we should be able to show the data. And once we can show the data, we can get the funding to do more than just a Minnesota thing. The second program we have, and please do ask me questions about that if you have them. I'm going to jump into the next thing, unless somebody, I don't know how you monitor that.
I'll just make a comment. Okay, the Robert Lifers program scared straight years ago. They had a program. Now, this was for the adults. The kids that ended up going to prison, okay, and they were lifers. And they had them out, the ones who were able to paint houses, say, that was one program. Others were more like plumbers because, you see, people have abilities. This is my point. You're speaking about the kids. A lot of times they don't make good employees because of where they've come from. A lot of kids are not even in touch with their own skills, okay? So I think it's important, you know, like for groups, like what you're speaking about in other groups, and even in foster care, they should have someone working with kids so that they can come in more touch. Is, hey, I can do this. I can do that. I'm not stupid. I can do this. I can do that. And so in that way, guiding them also to how to take care of themselves. You know, a lot of kids don't know how to use a credit card. They don't know how to use a check. They don't know how, you know, to pay the bills. And that's where the aftercare comes in and should come in, especially when kids are in foster care and they age out. And that can be also, too, from juvenile detention. They age out. So if they have guidance, this is something that's very needed. If someone teaches these kids, whether it be in the foster care system itself or say, even in the house that they're living in foster care, you know, how to budget. They don't know how to do these things, Mike. And then they get out. They've aged out. And they're supposed to live. And a lot of times there is no aftercare. There isn't a house that they can go into. Like when you get out of prison, they put you in the other house. And if you make it there, then you're out in society. They don't have that. So what you're speaking about, keep that in mind also, because, yes, we all have some kind of skill. And we have to, you know, come in touch with that skill. And the reason why kids many times don't make such good employees is because they were too busy surviving. They were too busy trying to survive. And so, therefore, they didn't have the opportunity as the kids who came from, as we call them, the normies, the normal homes, to say, have parents say, hey, you're good at this. Hey, you have the ability to do that. Hey, instead they were downed all the time. And that's what helped form them and put them in the position of, I can't do anything. I don't know me. I don't know me. Okay? So these groups that you speak about, if you can help kids to get in touch with who they are, help them find their skill levels, and you know, encouragement, 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 because that's something they never had.
And on top of that, the concept is they are, in fact, a peer group. So the idea is that at the end of the year, they know and trust each other. the person, the adult in the room that we have trained over the course of the year will still be their counselor, their guidance counselor in this area. We have access now. It's Lutheran Social Services has people that will volunteer to be mentors on an individual basis for counseling and different things. So we will be a resource to more. I just want you to know about that. It's one of these things that I think could be a national program pretty quick if we can get 2-3 of these groups up running and some data on them, you know, by the end of the year. I'd like to, there's no reason I couldn't go into any state. It's done virtually through Zoom. We meet, we talk, we provide access to banks. And frankly, in Minnesota, I have one bank that's actually out of Florida. They've got a location here. And I'm an old business person, so I've dealt with a lot of banks, and I'm pretty familiar with why they don't want to do this. I mean, there's really no money in it for them, but it's a community service that a few banks are looking at and saying, yeah, let us have a part of that. We know how important this is. It is stunning what this bank is doing for us. It is literally stunning. We can give a loan to a kid, tie it up in a CD. It makes its own payment. So they, you know, as long as they don't break a bunch of rules. Basically, we tell them just let us do this. We're going to give you some money, and we give them $1,250 on top of that to have the feeling of wealth. And at the end of the year, what they do is what they do. We figure we're going to lose half of them, but they will have had the experience. They will know how it happened. And how they can replenish. And if we get better than half odds on that, I'll be really happy. And the idea is that kids that didn't have a checkbook, didn't know how to use a credit card, fell for scams. I got scammed for $248 on eBay. I can laugh about these things. But these kids need these lessons. I've got a board member. That a lovely woman, she was taking care of her grandkids because her son had terrible drug problems, and she was so busy, so overwhelmed, and she had horrible financial problems. And she ended up buying a car that was worth $3,000. She paid $6,000, and the interest ended up being about 24%, and the car didn't work. Now, those are all parts of the course that we teach over a year. I call it a course. It's a group. These are sessions. We have. We want them to share their issues. We want them to grow in the year and trust people. And frankly, you put five people in a room, they have much more power than the person teaching the session. They know more. The combined knowledge of five people in a room is just way more than any one of them. So that's been proven. I'm an old peer group guide from years over the years, and you find that people really do start looking out for each other, and they have the same issues. And this one is multifaceted. It's something that has to be addressed at a high level. And the fact that we got a bank involved and that we've got Lutheran Social Services involved and that we can do things with the help of others, you know, that's a powerful thing. And I want this program to be much bigger than it is today. So I may actually share, if you'll let me, Carol, I've got a 3-minute video that explains it pretty well that I'd like you to have and remember me. And if you've got somebody that's interested.
Good. Send it to Bill because he does the website and he would post it. You know, that would be very good. And you see, the very fact that you just mentioned something a few minutes ago, that they are being more, they're starting more in social services to think about becoming mentors. That shows that they're, it's a little bit of an after program, you know, in a sense, because they know that they can go to them if they get into trouble, okay? Or when I say trouble, I mean, I forgot what you said about budgeting. I'll just use that, but whatever.
Yeah.
They can go back and, you know, be retrained again to teach them. Because these kids, they just had no upbringing. They were kids of the street, many of them. And many of us on NASCA
were kids
of the street.
Their parents didn't either in many cases, Carol. They come from homes where the parents couldn't do it.
Right.
And so the kids that we're teaching today are taking that information home. And
right.
It's helpful at so many levels.
Mm-hmm.
I know professors at colleges that told me, literally, one very, very bright man, I need that. Can I bring my wife?
That's pretty big.
You know, nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, we live in such a fast-paced, money-oriented society that anybody gets it that's not in business surprises me. I have been turned upside down. My it's funny because my business life was helping troubled entrepreneurs.
Right.
I've helped over 100 companies that were in trouble, privately owned. And that's the business that I've brought to the table in this meeting. And we've got a poverty coach licensed for schools that teaches the budgeting part. And then we've got a real serial entrepreneur that teaches the how to find a job, how to start a gig, how to make money and have fun part of it. So, you know, I think we got the trifecta for how to do this. It's just that we got to get it started and up and running and raise some more money for it. Because we're stuck on the $1,250. We want to make sure that at the end of the year they got enough money to look at and say, well, that's more than anybody gave me at one time before. You know, that sort of thing.
Well, you see, that's good, though. At least, you know, you're trying to get this together, and you will get it together. I have all faith that you will. And, you know, maybe more people can, you know, absolutely, and more people can jump aboard because people have good ideas. I mean, Michelle has said things, regular girl has said things, you know, and I've said things. We bring points out, you know, Michelle and I both have worked in prison systems and all this other stuff, so we know what happens. And that's why I can speak so easily about aging out, and she has her views on the aging out also and going into the homes that were so dysfunctional so forth. And regular girl mentioned cultural, and that's so true, because when you deal with all these different kinds of people, many times you are dealing with different cultures, and that can be very, you know, hard to work through. So, I mean, all the things that you're speaking about are things that are needed, okay? They're needed in the system because when those kids go into foster care or they end up, like when I worked at juvenile detention, we had police officers there. You said kids don't want to see police officers. Well, these kids committed adult crimes. We had to have police officers there. We had panic buttons. We would hit panic buttons and bars would come down and separate an area from a different area because there was a riot. I got my ears ripped. I know, okay? That's nothing. They liked me. They only ripped my ears. The others got their jaws broken, so I'm okay.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know. So what I'm trying to say to you is this. I mean, this is it's something that's needed, and you know, people need to, you know, they need to understand better about the system. They need to understand what part they can take in the, you know, as society. And again, and it was brought up several times. If you you know, if you talk about the Parker book and how much this is going to cost, and because there isn't enough good solutions with the system, and they're not doing the right things, and they could be doing more, you start hitting people's pocketbooks, and you'd say, hey, you know, I pay a little bit out of my paycheck because of this. I pay a little out of my paycheck because of that, because that's the truth. It might be a little small amount, but people have to pay a certain amount. And it's to help run these programs, okay, like detention and the other ones. So, you know, what you're doing is good. It's very good. And certainly I'm sure Bill will be happy to post the video. And the more that we can learn, the more that we can speak about, I want you to come back and let us know how you're doing. And certainly you know the number. You call in whenever you want, Monday through Friday. And, you know, listen to the shows. And, you know, if we all work under one thing that Bill and I always speak about, we all worked under one umbrella, okay, and gave each other ideas, no competition here, okay? If we're going to fix something that's broken, if we can, then we have to work together as a people to do that. And who better to do that than the survivors? We've been down those roads, okay? We've been on the streets. We've been here. We've been there. We've been there. We've been there, okay? And we ended up here. We're on NASCA. I don't know. So, yeah. So, you know, this is a good thing. So, you know, all types of information that we can share with each other to help for the improvement of mankind, for the improvement for our children who are someday going to turn into adults if they make it, if they make it, okay, is more than welcome. Now, we have about 7 minutes left. I'm going to give these last 7 minutes to you, you know, because it says here, Mike often speaks at local and national venues and has been the keynote speaker at businesses, community, religious organizations. Tell me about the religious organizations. What did they allow for you to speak about? I'm just curious.
I've been really lucky with the few that I have gotten involved with. I will, on the one side, tell you that I worked so hard for so long to come in at the top through the diocese at the Catholic side and Lutherans, and then there's a college here that teaches ministerial. And they gave me an award, actually, in front of 2,000 people, which I was quite surprised by, for the book when I wrote it in 2005. But getting in front of it's been a hands-off thing. It's been a hands-off thing. I didn't get through there until recently when I came up with this program that I just told you about, the financial literacy program. Their community outreach people have been supporting this. That's actually where about half our money's come from in the last 6 months. So I'm very pleasantly surprised to find out that you know, and I'm bifurcated as I talk to you about this, because on the one hand, it frustrates me no end that in particular the Catholic Church that had all the problems with priests and sexual abuse, where something like this they could have led on. You know, it's been mentioned, in my experience, about half the kids in child protection have been sexually abused. And not for a day or a week, but I mean for years at a time. And it's just stunning to me that they wouldn't come out and allow, and I had a couple of real high-level Catholic folks working with me to do that, and it just never went anywhere. So today we have this, and they're supporting it with money. And First Unitarian Society has been really wonderful for me. Our very first program is at the On Fire Ministry in Golden Valley, and they brought in their kids. The minister is someone I've known a long time, and he's going to be a great trainer. That minister is probably, well, I'm 70, you know, and he's 50, and when I'm gone, he will be doing this. He's just you'll see him in the video. He helped us make our video. It's done professionally. It's done with a video company. So we've had so many people step up to help us. I'm so proud of that. And I do believe that if we can get, this is a door opener into the foster care system, and I can expand it into other populations of homeless, youth, poverty, religious. At the moment, we have had the doors open to us in the foster care industry, so that's where we're going. And we're staying in Minnesota because we right now have a bank that's right here. I do know the bank's out of Florida. I haven't checked out where they've got multiple locations, and we do need the bank. You can't get a credit rating without the help of a bank. And believe me, I don't know other banks that will do this. I just don't. And I call on banks and I ask them, and I have yet to find one outside of this one. So I am just so happy. And there is a man that runs this part of the program for that bank. He came here penniless from Peru, and he is just, my kids love him. They love him. And how many people do you know love their banker? I can say it about mine.
That's unusual.
I work for me.
Yes, I don't love my banker. Go ahead.
It takes a long time as a business guy to understand how bankers see the world. And so I am more empathetic to them than most people are, because I know what it's like being a banker. It's really not fun. It's not. And especially when something goes wrong, when somebody goes broke, you know, it's just bad for everybody. So
yes,
you know, part of our program is you treat your banker right, they'll treat you right, You'll get a decent loan. You won't pay 18%. You won't get into trouble. We'll help you buy a house or get a lease on an apartment that's at a good rate. You know, interest rates are the death of most people, really, even if you have money, because we use those credit cards and it's just a bad habit. And there's so many things to get into there. But this program is one of those things that I think could, you know, right now there's not, I shouldn't say it so harshly, but foster kids have a terrible time in life. They do. They've been through hell on the front end, and now they're going into a home that they don't know anybody. And there's just a whole lot of reasons. It's traumatic. It's torture. Actually, the World Health Organization has defined torture as extended exposure to violence and deprivation, which is exactly what happened to the kids that became state ward children. They were in homes that for long periods of time, terrible things happened to them. So the traumas they suffer from, the behaviors they have that are outcomes of that trauma, make them a bad bank possibility. And I'm trying to be light and hard subjects. But so if they, and it's really a lack of skill. If we can help them build that simple skill, and it's hard, you know, and I know that, you know, Emily's our teacher on the budget side, so she goes in kind of deep into that, and I tell kids, and I allow, she allows me to say this, but I say, you know, if you're not capable of doing what she's showing you, get a napkin, get an envelope, write the numbers down. What's important is that you understand numbers, and when you know that that number is bigger than that number, you can't do that. If you do that, everything goes to hell. Don't do that. So we're a peer group. We're not a classroom where the teacher can't say hell.
There you go.
I hope that you don't get offended by me. But
no, I
know,
don't. These, offend me? Are you kidding me? Go ahead.
Yeah, you've been around the juveniles. You got the language.
Yeah, you bet I have, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? This is a very interesting show. It was a different show. Usually on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we have people come in, they tell a story, you know. But you have so much going on where you're trying to improve, you know, the system, whether it be whether to foster care or whatever it might be, or even the juvenile justice system and so forth, and life in general for, you know, for kids so that they have a future. This is important. Because without the guidance that we speak about with the aftercare, they're not going to get to what they need inside, okay, whether it be juvie or later on if they, you know, they don't get the help they need, they go to prison. But, you know, as long as it's a system like that where we don't have aftercare and we don't have people like you who are trying so hard to improve what we do have, then there's not going to be any change, Mike, okay? It's going to be very slow. And the kids are going to continue to commit suicide. They're going to continue to go out and riot on the streets like they're doing. That slowed down a little bit, knock on wood, okay? Things like that. And, you know, it's just the way it is. So I thank you so much for being on this show because you gave people things to think about, okay? We can all tell our stories.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great show, and I appreciate being here.
Yeah. And, you know, we can all tell our stories and everything. But on the other hand, we need solutions. And you're opening the doors. You're trying very hard to find solutions so that kids can do better. And if kids do better, that's a good thing because then we will have less crime. So thank you so much for being here. And send that video, you know, to Bill. And I want to thank the people that called in tonight. A couple of them dropped off. They had to leave early. But I just want to thank you so much for all that you're trying to do. And I have faith that you're going to do it. And I think Regular Girl, she likes what you were saying, too. She's here. So, but anyway, okay, so good night. I have to wind the show down now. I'm getting the cues in my ear. We'll get cut off in a second. So come back and keep us, you know, in line with what you're doing, okay?
Thanks a million, my friend.
Okay, no problem. Good night and God bless.
God bless.
Tomorrow, 'cause that's gone. Blog Talk Radio.